Less than 24 hours now till the midnight hard deadline when a heated special session has to end at the Capitol. Legislators trying to fill a budget hole threatening state services, looming June 30th when more than $1 billion in sales taxes expire. What will the state house do today? Two top experts join us to predict what will happen. LSU economist Jim Richardson, part of the influential panel that tells the legislature how much money is coming into the state, and Counsel for a Better Louisiana's Barry Irwin. Then a man who's lived a movie-worthy life, from rural Mississippi to plotting an island coup in Baton Rouge, arrested and jailed in Louisiana, now out with a fascinating new book on how he moved from federal prison to leading the BP oil spill cleanup in Mississippi. How did he journey from hatred to redemption? George Malvaney joins us next on Talk Louisiana, here as we talk about what's going on in Louisiana, coming up next today. Good morning and welcome to Talk Louisiana. I'm Julie Baxter Payer and I'm filling in for Jim Engster, who's out today working very hard, just not on the radio today. And I want to welcome you all to the show this morning. This is a very big day in state government. It's June 4th. By midnight tonight, the special session has to end at the Capitol. It's the second special session this year. It's the sixth since the beginning of 2016. A $29 billion budget is at stake. So far, it's made it out of the Senate as of yesterday afternoon over to the House, along with a revenue bill, to raise the money to fund that budget. But the big question is how much of a 1% sales tax that's supposed to expire on June 30th will be extended and for how long. And fortunately, you don't have to listen to me predict what will happen. We have two experts coming on to join us today, LSU economist Jim Richardson and Counsel for a Better Louisiana's Barry Irwin will join us in a moment. But right now, I want to thank LSU economist Jim Richardson. He's joining us here today on the air. And Jim, you're part of a very influential panel called the Revenue Estimating Conference that really kind of tells the legislature at various points through the year what how much money to expect to come in based on the measures that they've passed in their sessions. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Julie. How are you doing? Fine. Yeah, well, the REC really... It sets a limit to a certain extent. It says this is how much money you can spend, and that's it. And what we'll have to do is, once this special session is over, and assuming that they actually do pass a tax of some sort, and we'll have to come back in and say, yeah, this is how much money it really turns out. And we know right now approximately how much money it will turn out, but that will tell them, okay, you cannot budget a penny more than that.
And right now at 9 a.m. is the actual hour today that the legislative official schedule says that the House and the Senate will open up on the floor. Now, we know over the weekend and in the past week that the times that they've been scheduled to go in for various committees and opening on the floor have sometimes moved back as heated negotiations go on there at the Capitol. But as you stand here this morning on the last day of the session, and I will note it's a little unusual. Typically, a session will, in the past few years, has ended at 6 p.m. on that day, but there is no 6 p.m. deadline tonight, so we could be seeing a late night at the Capitol, which harkens back to the days of old that I'm sure you remember. But what do you see happening today, Jim?
Well, it's now, I mean, the House Senate, I mean, there are two bills that are really in play. House Bill 1, which is the appropriations bill, and House Bill 27, which is really the bill that authored by Lance Harris from the House, that was sent over to the Senate, but very late. Both of those bills got to the Senate very late last week. The Senate dealt with them yesterday, and they upped the spending closer to what the governor wanted in his original budget. And then they also changed the sales tax bill, and primarily they changed it in one way, and that is when the House sent it was a remember we put on a 1% sales tax back in 2016. Temporary. Now the question is, do we lower that 1% from 1% to a third of a percent, or do we lower it to from 1% to a half a percent? The House said a third. The Senate says a half. The governor wants a half. And now it's back in the House side, and they could merely accept the bill as the Senate changed it. I don't think that's going to happen, but they could do that, and it'll be over. in terms of the revenue raised, and then you have to talk about the appropriations. But I think that it's going to be, I think the House will probably reject it initially. It will then be sent to a conference, and they'll have to start negotiating among themselves as to what they'll get out of it. And I think the one thing really hard to negotiate with is if it's going to be half a penny or a third of a penny, that's almost non-negotiable. It's got to be one or the other. So somebody's
right.
got to give up there. Or somebody said, okay. And then I think on the edges there are things you can compromise on that perhaps will make both sides feel like they've won something.
Right. If you'd like to speak with Jim Richardson or ask a question, the number to call in is 1-877-217-5757. It's 1-877-217-5757. Jim, I know that there's been some talk from Republican legislators that some of the sort of dire nature of the messaging that's come from the governor and from some of the Democrats is sort of quote unquote scare tactics, that it really the services of the state aren't quite as threatened as maybe it has been portrayed. How do you see this year in terms of historically? Is it different this year in terms of what's at stake if the budget is not funded?
Well, in terms of certain programs and the way we have established this budget over many years under various administrations, Republicans and Democrats, there are just a few things you can cut. You can really say, because there's so many things that are, okay, automatically are constitutionally required. And you're back down to the education side, it's mostly higher education. And one of the major components there is what we call the TOPS program. And that is essentially providing high school students who make a certain score on the ACT, to do a certain amount of work as high school students, that we will essentially pay the state picks up the tuition. Well, that's a program that everybody likes, at least based on their votes. And that's cuttable, though. So do you want to cut that? Well, here it is, June, and we have not yet, the state has not yet confirmed how much it's going to pay of that top, if anything. And kids are getting ready to go to school in August or September. So, you know, it provides uncertainty. I think at the end of the day, TOPS will be funded fully, probably. But it's cuttable. The same is true for higher education. You can cut their budget. Well, here they are trying to plan for the next academic year. It's cuttable. And then the other big area where people focus on a lot is health care, because it is a big industry. It covers the state. And it has certainly grown for a number of reasons, most of them because of federal policy, not state policy necessarily. So everything, and you're going to cut somebody, you're going to hit somebody. So even if you're only cutting, say the budget is $29 billion, but that's a number that also includes all the federal dollars you spend, which is almost half of that. And then you get down to how much you need to cut. Only about $3 billion to $4 billion will be really cuttable in terms of having the ability to cut. So if you cut $500 million or $600 million out of $4 billion, it's a big number.
It affects
people badly.
Right. I know that the governor has talked a lot in the last 2 years about wanting to sort of stabilize the budget and not depend on temporary taxes. Do you see any progress on that front for our state over the last couple of years?
I think that bill the House sent to the Senate had an expiration date of this new tax of 2023. The Senate, when they sent the bill back to the House last night, their date was 2025. So in that sense, we have more than a couple of years, so almost permanent, I guess. So that's an improvement. In an ideal world, you would say there is no limit. Obviously, we can change the tax anytime we want to, but we don't need to have a deadline like that, which means that we will be forced to go back and reconsider in 2025. Now, the only reason, say, 2023 or 2025 makes some sense is because some of the federal tax changes are just passed back by the U.S. Congress in December. would expire too in 2025, which would have an impact on what revenue we might need at that time. So in that sense, you could justify the 2025 as being, okay, that's something we might want to consider because some other factors that we do not control may expire and they will affect our tax revenues.
Do you see a different sort of house in terms of the way that there has been so much resistance to a stabilization of the budget as the governor's been calling for, and yet not a real willingness to point out specific cuts? Do you see a different kind of legislator in the in the House today mm-hmm. than you did, or as this our typical budget fight?
Well, I think probably typical in some ways. I think there's no doubt that part of the issue is merely that there is a fundamental difference in terms of how much public spending should there be for services. And that's a philosophical difference that people on both sides are doing what they think is right for the state. I think the problem is at some point is the governor has to put out a specific budget. At some point, if you say, I'm going to cut $500 million, you have to be, okay, exactly what is it? Well, the governor has to do that. He has to be very specific. The House and the Senate could be a little bit less specific in terms of saying, we delegate that responsibility to you as the governor. But I think that's something that you really do better. And that separates the two. The governor cannot be non-specific. The House and the Senate can be a little bit less specific. But I think if they really want to say, try to end the appropriations, or they may say, okay, you can cut everything, but don't cut that. So they can give you some guidelines. At the end of the day, it's the governor's job, it's the division administration's job. They have to say, okay, we're going to put the cuts here or there.
Thank you, Jim Richardson, for joining us. Barry Irwin with Council for a Better Louisiana next. And welcome back to Talk Louisiana. I'm Julie Baxter Payer, filling in for Jim Engster, who's out today. If you'd like to call in and be part of the conversation, it's 1-877-217-5757. We're going to stay on the Capitol beat with a man who's been on the Capitol beat for many, many years, Barry Irwin. A lot of you know him. We're thrilled to have him in studio with us here with Council for a Better Louisiana. Barry, you've covered a lot of end-of-session days. This one could go till midnight. What's your prediction today?
Well, I hope it doesn't go till midnight. I don't know why he made the call to go till midnight. We used to do that in the old days, and that was no fun. But, I mean, you know, honestly, I think that it doesn't look like it, but you get a sense they're close enough. They've been talking about this long enough. They ought to be able to work this out in a reasonable time, but they tend to take all the time they have.
Well, and I'm sure you watched some of the goings-on yesterday. What was your impression of it? Looks like the Senate's willing to raise $540 million, the House somewhere around $400 million, $140 million apart in a $29 billion budget. Would seem like you could do the math and get it done, but there's politics in there.
Well, there's a lot of politics. I mean, actually, if you look at what the Senate did, they came pretty close to giving the governor what he wanted. When you add the other thing with the BP oil spill, he gets to close to $600 million. He was looking for $648. That's pretty close. The House, on the other hand, you know, they've been sticking pretty hard on not wanting to raise that sales tax very much or any taxes very much, and they have a different philosophy. The Senate philosophy is sort of to try and, you know, mitigate cuts or let's survive the best way we can. A lot of the House members actually want to shrink government, and it's not just about the taxes. It's about shrinking government. So those are the two things at play, but the truth is $140 million is not an unreachable gap for them to fill.
Where do you think the House wants to shrink government?
I don't think they know in a particular way or even care in a particular way. I think they just want to shrink the entity of government. And they've said as much. I mean, they think that our government is too large. They think that it grows too fast. They want to put the brakes on any kind of growth. And the way to do that, I think, from their philosophy is to actually make it smaller. And not in any particular area, because when you look at the particular areas, mostly they're all supportive of them. But they do want to just kind of shrink the beast, I think.
But it seems like each time they get to some sort of specific area to cut, they get calls from constituents and they sort of back off of that. And so do you think in the end they'll be willing to make significant cuts?
You know, I think that we've been through this so long, a lot of them are about ready to kind of throw their hands up and say, we need to go home and let's resolve this the best way we can. I mean, even with the sales tax, the difference between the House and the Senate version, we're talking a minuscule amount, really. 0.33 versus 0.5. I mean, that's 0.17 hundredths of a penny.
It's really 17 cents on every $100 that someone would spend.
So when you look at it that way, they're not that very far apart in terms of that. I mean, we'll see. I mean, there's always room. I've been saying 5.4%. I mean, 4.4 is where it may end up, and who knows.
Well, what do you see about this legislature and this particular budget? It's $1 billion that will expire June 30th, the sales tax, if it's not dealt with in some way by the legislature. And is it really that much more difficult a problem than we've seen in the past? Or what is the difference this year that we've had to have six special sessions since 2016 began?
Well, look, I think in the older days, you know, basically you had a House and Senate that would deal with this problem. They would have a little different philosophical approach, but they would just kind of roll up their sleeves and say, hey, we have to solve it. I think this time what we've seen is the House has grown, at least a portion of the House has grown much more fiscally conservative. And when you're talking about two-thirds votes, which is what we have to do to pass revenues or renew revenues in this case, even a minority number of folks on either side can really leverage the conversation. And I think in the first special session, you saw the Democrats leverage it to a large degree because they didn't want to vote for that sales tax, and they kind of put the brakes on that. This time, I think, you know, the Republicans or that faction within the Republican group has the upper hand. But again, I think that two-thirds vote is a big part of it. When you get down to just majority votes, I think, you know, it's much more of an even balance than it might seem. But we're still dealing with a two-thirds in this case for most of it.
Over the next year and a half, the governor's coming up to reelection, as are a lot of other state officials. How does this impact him in the fallout from all of these sessions at this point? What do you see? Has this hurt him politically?
Well, I think we still have to wait to see, particularly on this one, how it turns out. But, you know, my sense is if you look at the polling, the governor has not been that adversely impacted by this, if you look at those kinds of numbers. I mean, I think he's been able to fairly successfully kind of put the blame on the legislature. Now, they may not all see it that way, and certainly when you get into a campaign, people are going to use different kind of language to point blame at whomever. But I think so far the governor has come away fairly, you know, unscathed or in pretty good shape on this. But campaigns tend to redirect that messaging, and we'll see.
The Legislative Black Caucus has really exerted their power as well this session. Talk a little bit about how they've influenced the debate.
Well, I think in the first special session, they had a huge influence because a lot of those folks went back and, you know, they voted for a temporary sales tax of a penny, which is a very, very hard political vote for them to do for with their constituents. And they said, well, I'm not going to do this again. And so you saw them, I think, assert themselves very much in that special session by saying, no, we're not going to go that route. We want to keep it smaller. I think this time around, they wanted to get some kind of an income tax on the table. They weren't able to do that. But if you look at what happened in the Senate, they passed legislation that gave, well, in the budget, that gave some extra money to Southern, to Grambling, to GO Grants, which help lower income students, and also earned income tax credits. So they've been influencing the discussion quite a bit.
Phil from Jefferson Terrace is online. When Phil, you're on with Barry Irwin. What's your question? Okay, I don't know if Phil is able to be on the line. I apologize for that, Phil. We're trying to get you back on the line, but we weren't able to hear you. Barry, I know we just have a few minutes left here in our segment, but Council for a Better Louisiana has been concerned about the sales tax aspect of this, I assume because it's regressive. It hurts some of the hardest hit lower-income folks. How do you deal with that when trying to be practical and working with the legislature?
Well, it's hard. I mean, I think having the highest sales taxes in the country when you put state and local together is not a good thing to have, and we don't like the fact that, you know, we're also taking revenues away from local governments potentially to do things that they need to do. We would like to see that whole penny go away. That's the recommendation that we made as Cable and also on the task force, but practicality is practicality. We're at a budget crisis. crisis. We've got dollars that we need to raise. The options are very, very limited in terms of what the House has been willing to do. So, I mean, I think this is one of those things where you sort of have to bite your tongue, go for it on another temporary basis, unfortunately, although it's a little bit longer than it might have been, and live to fight another day for tax reform.
How do you think constituents are seeing all of this, just this constant over 2 years news of sessions going on at the Capitol? Are people tuning it out, do you think, or do you think that they honestly I see people rise up and call in when particular services are affected or talked about on a particular day? How do you think the average person trying to work and get their kids to school and summer camp and all is viewing this session?
Well, I think just as you described in a way, it's kind of just varies on your circumstance. I think for folks that, you know, have students or getting ready to go to college, they're worried about cuts to higher ed. They're worried about cuts to TOPS. They just don't want to see the hospitals and everything fall apart. I think there's concern there. But I think for a large group, it's just kind of a cynicism. I mean, we already see that, you know, to some degree at the federal level with a cynicism towards government. And I think it just exacerbates it at the local level, state level. And I think it's really unfortunate for trying to solve our problems.
And do you feel like some of the talk of cuts to services June 30th, if, you know, $640 million isn't raised, was a little dramatic? Or did you see that as actual math, that those services wouldn't be funded?
Well, I think it's dramatic in the sense it's worst-case scenario. And I think even the Senate tried to say during the regular session, we're not going to go with the worst-case scenario. But truthfully, we've seen this before in budget fights throughout the years. If you look back decades, the same type of thing has happened. It does get people's attention. Sometimes it hurts a little bit politically to do that. And I think certainly in the House, it kind of maybe has backfired a little bit on things. But I believe that's settled down, you know, to some degree at this point. And people are just trying to figure out, OK, what can we do to bridge this and get out of here and everybody save face to some degree? And I guess that's what we'll see today is how they save face, if they do.
Barry Irwin, always the calm voice in the storm, Council for a Better Louisiana and Legislature and People of Louisiana. The bell tolls for thee tonight at midnight, and we will see what happens for Louisiana's state budget. Coming back next with George Malvaney on Talk Louisiana. And welcome back to Talk Louisiana. I'm Julie Baxter Payer, and I'm filling in for Jim Angster, who's out today. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, it's 1-877-217-5757. It's 1-877-217-5757. We're in for a real treat in this last half hour as we move from the Capitol to rural Mississippi and a life growing up in the South that took a very interesting turn. And we have an author with us, George Malvaney, who's joining us, I believe, from Mississippi. He has a new book out called Cups Up, How I Organized a Clavern, Plotted a Coup, Survived Prison, Graduated College, Fought Polluters, and Started a Business. George, it's good to have you with us today on Talk Louisiana.
Thank you. Glad to be with y'all.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, the reason we were interested in talking to you is that you took quite a journey in your life. You started out in rural Mississippi. You talk about in your book how you loved camping around Pearl River, which a lot of folks in Louisiana know. And tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your hometown.
Yeah, I grew up outside of Jackson in the 60s, and really enjoyed swimming, fishing, hunting on the Pearl River up in the Jackson area, which, of course, runs down and comes down on the edge of Louisiana there.
Right. And you took a journey where you talk about that your family, you say, I don't remember any racial animosity coming from my parents, my grandparents, or any other members. My contact with black people was minimal. There were no black families in our neighborhood, and I didn't hang out with any black kids. We had a black maid, Leola. She and her mother, Liza, worked for us for years, and I was fond of them, but I can't remember ever talking to them about race or politics or anything personal. And then you talk about how in your book, you things got rough for you in high school and maybe beginning in middle school. And by the time you were in the Navy, you were recruited by the Klan. What happened there? What started that anger?
Well, you know, I want to back up just a little. Yeah, I grew up integration occurred when I was in fifth grade. And yeah, it was a couple blacks that were in our class at integration, but I don't remember any issues. You know, I just knew at that time I was so young there was some kind of social upheaval going on, but I wasn't quite sure exactly what it was. And then in middle school or junior high, as we called it, I went into a probably 75-80% African American school, and that's where things changed. I tended to start blaming blacks for many of the issues that I saw, and it was just not a good school. Very little discipline, some violence there, fights, nothing like you see today involving firearms or anything like that. But I started. That's where my racial beliefs started changing. Would have been in junior high, and then continued on into high school. And I ended up dropping out of high school. I never completed.
And so you come to a point in your book where you talk about you came to Baton Rouge one day in 1981. And you called your mother to tell her that you had a job offshore, but you were actually involved in a plot to try to overthrow the island of Dominica, if I have that right. And the plotting meeting happened in Baton Rouge. You say it was a cloudless Saturday, and the atmosphere in the van felt celebratory, like we were going to an LSU football game. You didn't know you were soon to be arrested, but talk about that day in Baton Rouge.
Yeah, that was would have been April 26th of 81. You know, I had been in the Navy and had been discharged, performing a Ku Klux Klan unit on board the ship, and got out in New Year's Eve of 79. And through my Klan contacts, I had been recruited into this plot, crazy plot to invade a foreign country with intent to overthrow the government. And that plot went on, rock and rolled along for, with my involvement, for about a year. And we were going to leave out of the Slidell, the marina at Slidell, and 10 of us met up that had all been hired as mercenaries. We met up in Baton Rouge at a hotel, and I don't remember which hotel, on the outskirts of Baton Rouge on the 26th of April. And met and did our planning, some planning there. And then on the, we spent the night there. And then on the 27th, we all packed up in our vehicles, traveled on to a marina where we board a boat, a large sport fisherman that had been hired to take us to Dominica, the Caribbean island. And can remember that day very well, or at least that night. We get down to Slidell, and we meet up with the folks that were supposed to be taking us to Dominica. Turned out they were undercover FBI and ATF agents, and they put us in it was like a U-Haul van. They put us in the back with all our gear to take us to the marina where we were going to leave from. And then it was at night. We back up, feel the thing backing up, coming to a stop. And a minute later, I hear those words, a loudspeaker, "You in the van. This is FBI. You are under arrest." Then they repeated it. The doors came open on the back of the van. There was nothing but bright spotlights in our eyes. Couldn't see anything. And it was an FBI SWAT team arresting us.
And there's a picture in your...
It all went downhill pretty quick.
Yeah, and there's a picture in your book of you outside the Orleans Parish Prison. You spent a little time there. You took a journey that really is a journey that can be seen as one of redemption and changing. But as a reader reads through this book, there's not a specific page where you say you changed your your whole outlook on life, but you do say that things started changing for you in prison, in federal prison, when you were writing letters for some of your cellmates who were African-American, and you began to understand, I guess, the similarities between you and your cellmates that maybe you wouldn't ever have anticipated. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I had I had been at the Orleans Parish Prison and in the federal court system in New Orleans, and then in July of 81, I was picked up and being taken to federal prison, and I kind of bounced around through the federal prison system, starting in Tallahassee, Florida, and then to the U.S. Penitentiary in Atlanta, which was a pretty rough joint, maximum security joint. And there was I'd been there a couple of weeks and was in solitary, and then was moved into a cell that had six bunks in it. There were already seven people there, and I got the eighth. It, I was the eighth person, a mattress on the floor. And about my second night there, one of my cellies came over to me. They were all black from D.C., all in for murder, all young. And it's dark, it's real quiet, and he comes over there, he eases over there after lights are out, and he asked, he said, "Can you write me a letter?" And he whispered it real, real low. He didn't want anyone to hear him, didn't want to show any weakness. So I said, sure, I was kind of curious. Well, he started telling me the things. It was a letter to his mother, and I started writing, putting it down and writing. He had an old crumpled piece of pad, paper and a pencil, and I started writing his letter for him. And then that went on for a couple nights, and then others would come to me in the cell, and they were all the same thing, very quiet, didn't want anybody to hear what they were saying, but they were very personal. Sometimes a few of them were to their sisters. What I started to realize was, you know, these letters are very much like my letters that I would be writing home, except they were totally illiterate. They could not read or write. And so that's why they were coming to me. And it you know, you got to think, remember back, a year prior to that, I had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, I had been kicked out of the Klan and realized it was a bad organization. It had been a terrible mistake. But I was just a year out of there. And it was kind of an awakening for me, an enlightening moment. And there was no quick transformation, but it started a decades-long process of getting away from some of my extreme racist beliefs. And that's where it started, in the Atlanta Penitentiary.
And you talk about actually separating yourselves in terms of contact from some of those former Klansmen in order to kind of move away from that. I'm going to speed ahead a little bit. You end up going and finishing college and getting into environmental engineering, working for the Mississippi DEQ, and then ultimately playing a lead role in Mississippi in the BP oil spill. You worked a little bit with Louisiana in that part of your life, right?
Yeah, I was chief operating officer of a company that with offices throughout the Gulf South, and our corporate office was in St. Bernard Parish. Actually, I think by then, by BP, we had moved in. Our corporate office was in New Orleans. So we had a big presence in Louisiana. And when BP hit, I was the chief operating officer of that company. And I dealt almost strictly with Mississippi, but our company dealt we had a very, very big presence in St. Bernard and Plaquemines Parish in the BP response.
We're going to pause for just a moment to take a break here on Talk Louisiana. When we come back, how do you reach across the aisle? George Malvaney's learned some and will share.
You know, on the Voice of Louisiana Agriculture Radio Network. At the Chicago Board of Trade this morning, July soybeans, 10.04.5, down 16 and 3/4. November, 10.21 and 3/4, down 16. August soy meal, $370.80, down $4.60. August oil down 32 at $30.99. July cotton, $92.74, down 56. New crop December, $91.09, down $127. July corn, 383, down 8.5. September, 392.25, down 8.25. July rice, 1129, down 15.5. September, 1117, down 13. July wheat at Chicago, 508.5, down 14.75. September, 526.25, down 14.5. July sugar unchanged, 24.95. September unchanged, 25.80. At the Mercantile, June live cattle, 105.15, up 25. I'm Don Molino on the Voice of Louisiana Agriculture Radio Network.
There's always a need for cultural information, and there's always a need for grain and cattle quotes. There's always a need for being aware of how that weather is going to affect your workday. QT Market Center has a toll-free telephone number that may be very important to you when you need this type of information. 800-240-8761. When you need that information, let's see how smart your smartphone can be, or your desktop, or tablet. Call QT Market Center at 800-240-8761.
This is Trace Atkins for Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation. You know, your Louisiana Farm Bureau membership gives you access to the best insurance on the planet, but it can also save you hundreds when you buy a car. On vacation, your Louisiana Farm Bureau membership gets you discounts on hotels and rental cars, and it makes you part of a group that's 143,000 families strong. So go to lafarmbureau.org or call your parish Farm Bureau office to become a member. The Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation, the voice of Louisiana agriculture.
Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. I'm Julie Baxter Payer. The book is called Cups Up, and the author is George Malvaney. He's joining us this morning here on Talk Louisiana. And George, we've talked a little bit about the story of how you rose above a difficult time and perhaps some beliefs that you've turned away from. We live in a very polarized society. Obviously, a lot of folks separating into their political camps, and you've sort of made a transition from a very, conservative upbringing in a rural area to maybe a more moderate position. But in terms of interacting with people, how did you learn to sort of reach across the aisle and understand people that maybe at one time angered you or that you hated?
Well, again, it's hard for me to say exactly how that happened. I know it started in prison. I was actually selected to be on an inmate advisory committee for the prison I was in. I was represented the white convicts, and I was in a role where I dealt with all the races there, and we tried to diffuse problems, and the others that were on the I'm outside and I have a bunch of clothes around me. You may can hear them. But, I was in a role where I had to deal with others in a way to diffuse problems. So it started there. And then when I moved and I got out of prison, I went to college. And again, ideas had begun and beliefs had begun to moderate. And at some point or another, and I can't say just when, I've reached a position where I put friendships over political beliefs, and in my business dealings as chief operating officer of a relatively large company, you learn about compromise and dealing with people who have totally different ideas and beliefs from you. It could be personal, political, or business. And I think that was at some point I transformed into that. And I began to realize you got to reach across the aisle. You got to deal with people that you don't necessarily agree with, but you got to try and find that common ground to reach some kind of agreements. And I see you mentioned a polarized society. It's an extremely polarizing society that we live in, and Republicans not wanting to deal with Democrats, Democrats not wanting to deal with Republicans, and find that middle ground. And I think that's a shame where we see government going in this country.
One of the things you talk about in your book that's intriguing is you work in environmental regulation. You consider yourself now sort of along the lines of a moderate Republican, if not in party, but sort of in stance. And yet you think environmental regulation is very important. Talk a little bit about, even from a young age, why that was so important to you.
Well, I can remember back when I was early 70s, a major fish kill that occurred on the Pearl River, and my father telling me that, you know, it had come from a sulfuric acid release from a plant and the lack of environmental controls. And that always stuck with me. And then after I had gotten out of prison, went to college and graduated and worked 10 years with the Mississippi Department of Environmental Quality after my felony conviction was set aside, I really saw a great need for environmental regulation. And I dealt primarily in the emergency services branch, where I dealt with many spills, chemical and oil, across the state. And there's no question. I think, I'm not a member of the Republican Party or Democratic Party. I tend to align politically more with the moderate Republicans, not always, but on environmental issues, there's great need for environmental regulation.
The number to call in if you'd like to be a part of the conversation is 1-877-217-5757. It's 1-877-217-5757 if you'd like to talk to George Malvaney. And George, you do talk about, as you share your experiences in the cleanup after the BP oil spill, that you saw a difference in the way Louisiana and Mississippi sort of approached the cleanup. You talk about Louisiana sort of being a parish-led, parish-by-parish sort of cleanup effort, and Mississippi was more a state-headquartered effort. Can you talk about the difference in the impact you saw with those two approaches?
Yeah, I was working very closely with Governor Barbour at that time during the oil spill. I was in an operational lead position for the cleanup in Mississippi. We were the prime contractor for BP. And I was also, Governor Barbour had taken me in, where I worked very closely with him and his staff and the agency heads. And as part of that, I was involved with the weekly governor's conference calls they had. The governors of each of the Gulf states would have a conference call and discuss what was going on in their states, respectively. And what I saw was, in Mississippi, you had a very centralized response with the governor's office, large and in charge. And I saw more in Louisiana. I think it appeared that Governor Jindal didn't quite take as strong a role as Governor Barbour. It was, and I don't mean that in a critical way, but what I saw was the parish presidents having a much, much more powerful role parish by parish compared to the coastal counties in Mississippi.
And how do you think that impacted the speed or the approach to cleanup?
You know, just my personal opinion, I think the centralized approach in Mississippi may have been more effective. Governor Barbour was able to have much influence in directing operations and resources to the estuaries or the county, or a part of a county where it was badly needed to protect the environment. And I saw, you know, you saw like Jefferson and Plaquemines Parish really, really taking some hard hits, but I saw many resources that were probably could have been much better used in Plaquemines or Jefferson that were moved to St. Tammany. And I just didn't think that was as effective approach, with the parish presidents in the taking a lead rather than a more global response.
The book is called Cups Up, and the author is George Malvaney. George, what made you write the book?
Well, during the BP spill, I was in a very public role in meetings with U.S. senators and congressmen, the governor and lieutenant governor, and the press was seeing me, and then someone tipped them off that I'd been about my past, and they did a front-page article on me in the Sun Herald newspaper on the coast, and I got a lot of many, many comments. You need, when people heard about my past, how did I go from that, my old days as a Klansman and felon, ex-con, to leading this BP response? You know, how did you go from that to this? And I heard many comments. You need to write a book. You need to write a book. I heard that dozens of times.
And now you have, and it's called Cups Up. And I think a lot of people wonder when they first look at the cover of the book or the title, what does that mean? Do you want to share what that phrase, why is that the title of your book?
Yeah, Cups Up. I had, was my first day in prison in Tallahassee, Florida. Marshals had picked me up in at the Parrish Prison in New Orleans and taken me over to Tallahassee, Florida. I spent the night, and I was the first morning in the prison. I wake up, it was just brutally hot in my cell, and in July of 81, and I'm hearing this call this way down the cell block, Cups Up, Cups Up, somebody hollering that. Well, while I'm hearing that, I'm sitting there thinking, what am I doing here? It just really hit me. You're going to need to change your life. You're going to spend the rest of your life sitting in a prison cell. If you don't do some things different, you've done some bad things, some wrong things, and made some very poor decisions, some bad life choices. And I knew I needed to turn those around. Well, I kept hearing that Cups Up. Finally, a prison orderly appeared in front of my cell as I'm having this conversation with myself. He looks in at me and stares at me and says, you want any effing coffee or not? And I figured out then what he meant was they'd given me a plastic coffee cup the night before it, receiving and discharge, held it up through the bars. He splashed the coffee in it. It went on down the aisle, continuing calling out Cups Up. And I looked down in my coffee. It was gray. I could see my reflection in it. It was a bad reflection. It was not a good reflection. But the Cups Up, that was the morning that I really made a commitment and a promise to myself to turn my life around.
George Malvaney, he's the author of Cups Up. George, it's been a pleasure speaking with you this morning. I think you've shared a story that a lot of people may be able to learn from. Cups Up, How I Organized a Clavern, Plotted a Coup, Survived Prison, Graduated College, Fought Polluters, and Started a Business. We wish you all the very best, George, as you move ahead in your private business that you're in now. Thank you for joining us. And I thank you. I'm Julie Baxter Payer, for joining us today on Talk Louisiana with Jim Inkster, and he will be back on Wednesday.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.